This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, September 16th, 2020. I'm Caleb Brown. Contact tracing is invasive. Data retention policies by governments are less than clear. And given the limitations of the technologies in use, contact tracing may not be very effective. In the Cato Institute's new report, Pandemics and Policy, Cato's Matthew Feeney and Julian Sanchez contribute a chapter detailing some better practices to protect privacy for contact tracing. At the beginning of this pandemic, contact tracing was one of the many solutions that was thrown out there, and a great debate raged between public versus private, and to what degree the state would know things about us, frankly. Where does that stand now? How many states have undertaken contact tracing, and how have they done it?
It's actually hard to say. One thing we're seeing is that the uptake of digital contact tracing, of technology-assisted contact tracing, specifically using smartphone-based applications, has been a lot slower and more spotty than anyone, I think, really had expected. There was an instance, and I think it was Utah, where an app was developed and rolled out, but had enormous issues and frankly, privacy problems with sharing information inappropriately with third parties. I think Colorado is poised to become the first state to roll out an app that is integrating the new Apple Google model, and there's a handful of states, I think, frankly, maybe four or five states have indicated an intention to adopt the protocol that those two companies jointly developed that uses Bluetooth proximity sensing to detect or do as a proxy for proximity and therefore potential exposure to COVID. But, you know, the vast majority of states may be doing some kind of manual contact tracing, but have not prioritized the digital version. And indeed, we've seen states that began developing contact tracing apps essentially back off that and focus on other priorities. I think that's in part because even manual contact tracing, which is a more familiar process, that is, you're not tracking people's proximity or location with their phones, but you are having teams of trained interviewers trying to talk to people who are diagnosed with COVID, and then manually try and phone up people that they've been in proximity to, are essentially non-functional. And you have a lot of parts of the country where effectively they're abandoning even that or have essentially given up on it, because there's a whole infrastructure that is necessary to make contact tracing work meaningfully. So if you don't have relatively rapid turnaround testing, at some level, there's not that much point. If you find out 5 days or a week later that you have tested positive and now you're going back and trying to tell people to quarantine that you had contact with a week ago and have been not quarantined in the interim, at some level, you know, you're not doing a whole lot of good there. So you need the infrastructure for relatively rapid turnaround testing, so you can catch people before they've spread it, which is the goal. And at some level, you need fairly widespread participation. And so the other problem that the manual contracting tracing is seeing is that in lots of parts of the country, contact tracers, you know, have training and communications problems, cannot get a hold of people who are they're trying to contact, and frankly find that people aren't interested in participating. I think on what I've read, at least, is that on college campuses in particular, there is a fairly low level of participation with contact tracing. So, in a sense, lacking that infrastructure, and, you know, I think all experts agree that the digital contact tracing, technology-assisted contact tracing, is never going to be a sort of silver bullet on its own. But to have an effective contact tracing system that relied primarily or exclusively on sort of the app-based approach, you would need something like 60-80% of the population to have downloaded and installed this app, and that's just not going to, you know, you don't even have that for Instagram or Facebook. So this needed to be a supplement to manual contact tracing. And I think, you know, what we're seeing is that in most of the country, we don't really have the infrastructure for a useful, functional contact tracing system.
Given the limitations of the technology, Matthew, why are states pursuing it?
Well, there are a number of, I think, obvious political reasons, which is a lot of officials all across the country are in a position where they have to look as if they're doing something. And we've seen across the country numerous different approaches to tackling the ongoing pandemic. And certainly utilizing technology is one way to do that. But for reasons I think Julian outlined, that there are certain limitations there. And I think there are certainly technological and infrastructure issues that should make us cautious of certain approaches, but there are also civil liberties concerns. And certainly the chapter that we've put together tries to highlight ways in which, if technology-assisted contact tracing is going to be used, that we can limit the civil liberties concerns. We should remember that if you grant that cell phones are usually a good proxy for the location of their owners, which is, I think, a fair assumption, we also have to grant that they reveal rather sensitive information about personal lives, religious affiliations, health status, and other things like that. And there's that issue. There's also, I would say, the other issue of potential over-inclusion, which is if I'm in a car and I have this contact tracing app installed, and then a bus pulls up next to me and one of the passengers has the same app installed and later tests positive, although we were within physical proximity, the actual risk of exposure was relatively limited. So that's another issue that ought to be considered. Frankly, I think as I think Julian put well, we're sort of at the point of we're beyond the point of this kind of method being particularly useful, at least in many parts of the country hardest hit. But what I think we tried to do in the chapter was to emphasize that any data collected this way should be reserved for response to the pandemic and should not be handed out to other to law enforcement officials. And downloading the app should not be a condition for certain federal benefits. That's, I think, you know, a number of the points that we raised include those. I mean, there are others we can discuss, but I think those are perhaps the two most important.
I would say it's important to recognize that contact tracing is most useful in a specific context, which is to say, when you have the virus largely under control, you are perhaps in a position to start reopening things, and you want to ensure that you are able to nip new outbreaks or new transmission in the bud before they become a serious problem. If you're in a situation where you effectively have kind of uncontrolled transmission, contact tracing is relatively not that useful there, right? The idea is if you've got something under control and want to keep it contained, want to prevent it from beginning to spread out of control again, contact tracing is likely to be very useful. If you're not at that stage yet, then, again, especially if you don't have relatively rapid turnaround testing, contact tracing is less useful. So as we progress, as we get to a point where things are more open, where, perhaps there's not wide distribution of a vaccine yet, but things are more under control, I think that's a scenario where, and especially when perhaps public health agencies are less swamped, where you'll start to see more focus on, all right, well, can we, solidify and lock in the gains we've made via greater contact tracing to prevent this from becoming a second or a third wave?
What about the data? To the extent that states are looking into this, I assume Google and Apple, who have their own issues with data preservation, I assume state-level contact tracing that does not make use of high-tech protocols. What do we know about what their plans are for the data, or if it's just going to sit there, or if they have some sort of strict protocol for destroying it?
So with respect to the technological approaches, if you're using the Google Apple model, that is essentially as decentralized as it's possible to be. So if you're talking about technology assisted contact tracing using the Google Apple protocol, in that instance, the data about proximity is transmitted using anonymous Bluetooth identifiers. So you don't have someone's name or identity. What you have is just transmission of a cycling anonymous string. And so the phones are essentially recording a database of anonymous strings they've received from other phones, and then later checking that against a list of confirmed positives that whose anonymous strings are then uploaded to a public list. But essentially, all the contact data is anonymized, actually anonymized in a relatively meaningful way, and is stored only on individual devices themselves. So there's no central repository in that case. So to the extent that is the mechanism for contact tracing, there isn't really a question of data use restrictions or data privacy issues, because there is no centralized store of data. The data never essentially leaves the end user's phone. But of course, many states have their own models, or are doing manual contact tracing, or have their own apps because they think it's useful for the public health authorities to have more centralized data. And there you really do have to look state by state and see what the individual public health authorities' rules and policies are. I do think one of the concerns folks have about this is that they are so overwhelmed that it's hard to have a clear picture of how every different state is meaningfully implementing restrictions on the data they're gathering, which I think is in turn perhaps part of the reason you have in a lot of places relatively low compliance and participation with contact tracing. People want to be assured that if you're in the case of manual tracing, you're talking to an interview and telling them, well, who did you spend last night with, or what social event, perhaps were you at a time when it's frowned on that if you were at a social event, and people, want to be assured that that's not data that's going to come back to haunt them.
At this point, it seems like contact tracing is a solution in search of a well-fitting problem. Julian, you noted that at some point down the line, it may be useful, in fact, very helpful to prevent outbreaks. But, as states appear to want to look like they're doing something, and technology offers a potential solution, is there something that they clearly ought to be doing?
I would say that when it comes to the specific technology we've been discussing, in many parts of the country, the horse has left the barn. However, the depressing reality of the world we live in is that we will face one of these pandemics again, and we can at least take a look at the current situation and perhaps learn this lesson from it. And I think it's fair to say, and Spencer Ackerman at the Daily Beast wrote a good article about this. It's fair to say that if we'd acted earlier and used the technology when we knew that this was potentially going to be a huge issue, the technology could have been useful, and given certain privacy protections would have been valuable. However, I do expect that because states have an incentive to look aggressive on this, there may well be more state-level contact tracing apps developed, but that in many parts of the country, I don't see them being particularly useful. However, we do know that something like this will happen again, and when it does, I hope that we can at least learn some lessons about the effectiveness of technology-based contact tracing and when it should be deployed. I think it's fair to say in the United States, it was too late.
I mean, I also say, I think, given the realities of cross-border and cross-jurisdictional transit in the U.S., a system where we are sort of expecting people to find and download the individual app produced by or for their state, which may or may not work with the app that is being downloaded and used in the next state over. And, a lot of people live in one state and work in another. People who work in New York but live in New Jersey or Connecticut, that is not necessarily a super useful model. And so I think one of the things that makes this less useful is, you know, don't necessarily know what they have to do or what they need to download. And you have systems that, you know, frankly, are not going to be that useful if they do not work together. If you have people in two adjacent states and the apps, you know, either are not talking to each other or are not consulting the same, you know, so the same notification lists, or just in general are not designed to necessarily be compatible, the utility drops off significantly. And so to some extent, there's a kind of collective action problem where, you know, if you're in one state, but all the other states around you haven't got their systems up and running and functional yet, then, well, at some point, maybe this is not the best place to invest your resources.
Julian Sanchez is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Matthew Feeney directs Cato's Project on Emerging Technologies. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast anywhere you please, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.